G'day, it's Gus Warland here, host of Not an Overnight Success, the only podcast in the world that gives $10,000 to the charity of the guest to give away every single episode. Today, it's Charlie Teo. This episode, you'll see a side of Charlie that perhaps you haven't seen before. Very, very tough upbringing. Medicine, being a doctor, was not part of his plan. In fact, he started a motor mechanic apprenticeship. One part of the interview that I really enjoyed was when I got vulnerable and then I saw Charlie get vulnerable. He's a guy that does not toe the party line. I hope you enjoy the chat that I had with Charlie.
Now that we know you're an internationally recognised neurosurgeon, but I want to take us back to that time when you were just a child. What were you like as a child? Where were you born? Give us your sort of childhood.
Oh, well, in a nutshell, I was the an ultimate nerd
okay.
as a child. So it was difficult in those days. I mean, there were two Asians in my school, so there was a lot of anti-Asian sentiment. You know, it was in the days where people were still anti-Japanese because of the Second World War. And, of course, they couldn't tell whether we were Japanese or Chinese, so they lumped us all together and just called us the Yellow Peril. I mean, you either rose above it or you sunk from that attitude. And I'm pleased to say that, you know, I sort of became a black belt in karate and thought, oh, bugger this, I'm not going to let them get me down, and sort of tried to rise above it. But it was a relatively modest childhood. My father was a doctor, so it could have been, you know, with the silver spoon in my mouth. But no, it was hard love. In fact, he used to, you know, beat me up quite a bit. And
really?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. So it was one of those sort of relationships where if I went to school, for example, got picked on at school, got bullied at school, I'd come back and he would sort of, you know, sort of get very upset that I didn't stick up for myself, and used to give me a good whooping for not sticking up for myself. And, you know, that's my memory of my childhood, actually. Pretty hard childhood. Never had a holiday. They believed that in order to get a good sense of value of money, that I'd have to work every school holiday. So I worked every school holiday, doing something like being a bowser boy at a gas station or a rouseabout on a farm, doing the milk run.
When I hear you say that, that actually makes me sad.
Well, again, you could be sad about that childhood, but then that's cliche-ish, but it builds character, and you have to try and make the best of that bad sort of childhood.
Mm.
And I think it contributed a lot to my tenacity now, and the fact that I've, you know, the sort of things that I've achieved, I'm not quite sure I would have had the foundation or the fortitude to have tackled a lot of the things that have happened to me since if it wasn't for that hard childhood.
Mm.
So, oh, look, I don't recommend it.
Yeah.
To people.
It's not the way that you brought up your kids.
Exactly, exactly. I wanted my children not to have to experience that, to have a nice, pleasant childhood with holidays and loving parents, and they're still high achievers, so it's not what I would want for my children. But I don't look back on my childhood and think, oh, God, I wish it was different.
Mm.
Yeah. You make the best of what you get.
Yes. So that was your dad pretty much sort of running the show there. What about mum?
Mum was your rock of Gibraltar. She was the one who was always there for you when you needed her. Like, my father beat me up so badly once that I bled. I had a laceration and my mum had to stitch me up. And yeah, she was always there for me, and she was my rock. And they divorced when I was 9. Basically, I was raised by a single mum.
Was there more love after Dad was out of the picture?
Well, she's very Chinese, so it wasn't that demonstrative love. It was showing love, like, you know, cooking for me, coming to watch me play football, despite me being a very bad footballer. And being, I was never in the A team. I was always in the B, C or D team, you know. So for her to come along and watch that, I'm sure it wasn't entertaining for her, but she just, it was a way, her way of showing that she loved me.
Yes.
And supported me. But no, she never said, the first time she said, I love you, was when I was 40 years old.
Yeah. Really?
I'll never forget it. Yeah. I love you. And that was the first time it ever came out of her mouth.
So you were 40. What had you done to get that I love you?
I was living in America and I came back to visit her, and at the airport when she was saying goodbye to me to go back to America again, she said, I love you.
Did you sort of stop?
Yeah, double take.
Yeah.
Like, What happened then?
Did I hear that right?
Yeah, yeah. You know, the sort of mother shit, you know.
Yeah.
Very Chinese, very traditional. You didn't say things like that. Yeah, it was hard love.
She did it her way, in the way that she had been brought up.
Yeah, exactly.
So you're a 9-year-old boy, your dad leaves, mum's looking after you, you're not very good at football.
No.
But you're very good at academic stuff. Are you top of the class? Are you ducks? Do you have to work hard for your results?
I had to work hard. The ducks was a Chinese guy who was, you know, a genius, and it came pretty easy for him. I guess the first five were all, you know, really clever guys. I was in the top 10, but I had to be in the top 10 because after the divorce, it was always conditional, those divorces in those days. And my father wanted to take me out of private school to save himself money, but the condition of the court was that if I stayed in the top 10, then he couldn't take me out of school. So there was a lot of pressure to be in the top 10 of the year every year.
Oh, yeah. God, on top of all the other pressures of being a teenage boy.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It was hard. I had to work really hard to stay in the family because I'm not like those guys who are naturally brilliant. I had to work hard to stay in that.
So there you are. You're working hard to staying in the top 10. Any brothers and sisters?
A sister who was very doting when I was a little boy. In fact, so much so that she did all the talking, and I actually didn't start speaking until I was about 4 years of age. My parents thought that I was special needs, and they put me in a special needs school. Because they sent me to Trinity Grammar first, and because I couldn't speak, they said, look, I'm sorry, you can't come here. So they put me in a special needs school. And at the special needs school, apparently I looked around and thought, shit, I need to get the hell out of here. And so I started talking, so they put me back into Trinity.
Yeah. Right.
My sister is very, she does a lot of talking. She talks a lot, and she did all the talking for me, so I never needed to develop those skills.
Right, there you go. Yeah. Are you close to her now?
Yeah, yeah. Now she's a lovely person. Like I say, she still talks a lot. But you know, she's got a great heart.
Yeah, big heart. Did you guys get born here or did you come across?
No, we were born here. Dad came over to do medicine and Mum came over to do nursing from Singapore.
Okay.
So we were born here.
So when you go back to Singapore, if you go back to Singapore, do you feel any link here at all?
Yeah, no, I do. I did that program, Who Do You Think You Are? And until then, I had no desire to learn about my ancestry. You know, I'm one of these sort of present sort of guys or future guys. I didn't want to look back in the past. But when that program looked back in my past, I went back 23 generations. I found it absolutely fascinating. And so when we went back to Singapore, it was a real eye-opener for me and quite cathartic in many ways because I realized then some of my traits were not my traits, so traits of my ancestors, and it was all genetic and it had nothing to do really with my upbringing. It all had to do with genes.
Mm.
Yeah, very, very fascinating, really.
That's great. So that journey you went on, going back all those generations and so forth, was there one sort of moment that you went, I'm so glad I'm going through this journey,
Yeah, because
we
all question our own motives sometimes, and sometimes we think, you know, am I a good person or, you know, why am I such a weirdo? And when you look back in your ancestry, you realize that, in fact, some of those traits that you had came from epigenetics. They came from the fact that you had to be this or you had to do that to survive. So one of my traits, for example, and I'm not saying it to be boastful, but I'm incredibly tenacious. I will not give up. And you could tell that from my background that back in Fujian province, in the days of Genghis Khan, my family were very, very tenacious and they held to the moral high ground. And, you know, sometimes I think, you know, do I do charity work because I'm a good person or do I do it because it makes me feel good? In other words, is it a selfish thing? And, you know, you question yourself about these sort of things. And I realized, you know, there was a lot of charity back in my family where they're good people and, they tried to lift others up to a higher standard. And so it did explain a lot of the traits that I often questioned myself.
Yeah, I think more of us should go back and do that type of thing if you can.
No.
It's becoming more and more popular, isn't it, sort of the ancestry type stuff.
Yeah, and I can see why now. I really, and I had no interest at all before that program.
Yeah, that's good.
Mm.
So you're a teenager. You found your voice. Did you find your voice properly at any stage? Well, or a moment you can go back and go, oh, as a 15-year-old, I felt like I was on the right path because your sister had done so much chatting. Your dad's left for a few years now.
Yes.
At what point did Charlie Teo become Charlie Teo, you reckon?
Okay, I think I was a bit of a late starter. I was still wanting to be one of the boys when I was at school. I think most kids...
Yeah, fit in.
...like to fit in. So at school, when I obviously stood out, not just from appearance but from my personality, I hadn't found myself. I didn't like myself. I wanted to be one of the boys. I wanted to be white. I often lay in bed thinking, God, I wish I didn't look Chinese. I wish I was good at sports so I could be one of the boys. Mm. And so it wasn't at school. It wasn't until, I guess, university years that I thought to myself, actually, you know, I should be more proud of who I am and not try and be someone that I'm not. But no, at school, I have to confess, I really yearned to be so-called normal.
Yes. So were you always going to go to university?
No. No, not at all. Part of that yearning to be something else was I wanted to be good at sport and strong and muscular and stuff. So I got into karate and I got my black belt and I wanted to be a bouncer. I wanted to be a security person. I wanted to own my own security firm. So there was that ambition. I also wanted to be a politician because I wanted to make changes to society. I wanted to be a lawyer because I was in the debating team and I was a good debater. And so I wanted to be a lawyer. So there's a lot of things I wanted to be. And some of them did not include university. In fact, I wanted to be a motor mechanic and I did. I started a motor mechanic apprenticeship, but was treated with zero respect.
Oh.
And I thought, I need to do something where I'm treated with a little bit more respect. Yeah, and so I guess I kind of fell into medicine. It's not as if my parents encouraged me to do it. They didn't. I got the marks to get into medicine, and just one thing led to another. But yeah, I wasn't really passionate about medicine until I did it. Yeah, so I don't want you to think it was one of those stories where right from when I was a kid I wanted to be a neurosurgeon, a brain surgeon. That wasn't the case. It was one of these things where it was almost like serendipitous.
Hmm. So your dad's left it when you were nine. Do you have a relationship with him at all after that point?
No, he beat the crap out of me so much so that he had a restraining order. An ABO. So it was a very acrimonious relationship where I was poisoned a little bit by my mum, who obviously, he had another family and had committed adultery. And so the divorce was on the grounds of adultery. In retrospect, a lot of my opinion, my father was tainted by my mum. Now that I'm a man, I realise that we all have our failures and we all have our problems, and so I'm a little bit more understanding of his situation. But no, I hated him, and I didn't want anything to do with him for 20, 30 years.
So you find yourself in medicine.
Mm-hmm.
At what point through the course do you go, oh, actually, this is not just me doing a degree and, a pretty good life afterwards. This is something that I'm good at and I'm passionate about and you're into it.
Yeah, well, that didn't come until later either.
Okay.
So medicine to me was something that I enjoyed, but no, I wasn't really good at it. In my day, the system was high distinction, credit, and pass. And I got passes and everything. I got a credit in something, but I never got a distinction in anything. I knew I was good with my hands because I liked doing things with my hands, and I started an apprenticeship in motor mechanics, and I was good at it. And I always played with Lego and Meccano sets, and I knew I was good with my hands. So I thought, oh, well, being good with my hands, I should do surgery. But I don't know. I never really got on well with the surgeons, and I was never really part of the fraternity or one of the boys. I never felt that comfortable, even though I loved surgery itself. So, no. Again, the answer is I really didn't know my calling and I didn't know what I really wanted to do until I fell into it, essentially. So I guess medicine was a means of getting to neurosurgery. Again, all through serendipity. Because, as it turns out, because I knew I wanted to do surgery, I started doing pediatric surgery. I like kids. I like surgery, so the natural thing towards pediatric surgery, but I hated it. I'd never had a mentor in it. I found it a little bit boring. It didn't challenge me mentally and didn't really challenge me physically either. But then I was thrust into neurosurgery. I was doing call as a pediatric surgical registrar, and the neurosurgical registrar got ill with hepatitis, and so he was out for the count. So they asked me to pick up his call. So I was thrust into neurosurgery, even though I never wanted to do it. In fact, I didn't like it at all as a medical student.
So when you say pick up the call, what does that mean for people non-medical?
So when a head injured patient or a neurosurgery patient came into the emergency room at night, I was asked to assess them and look after them, despite the fact that I was doing pediatric surgery and not pediatric neurosurgery. So I was really thrust into it, thrown in the deep end. And from there, the rest is history. I fell in love with neurosurgery once I actually was thrust into it.
Yeah, so it sounds like you bumbled and fumbled your way to where you ended up, where you were happy.
No one's put it that way before, Gus, but you're right.
Okay. So at what age are you fumbling and bumbling and going, oh, this is actually quite good?
Yeah, that was right up until they did neurosurgery, which was, I don't know, 28.
And at that stage, are you a single man? Are you?
Yep, I'm single, playing the field, being a naughty boy, thinking I'm pretty hot because I'm a brain surgeon.
So when people actually ask you what you're doing and you say a brain surgeon, they're like, yeah, sure, what are you really doing?
Exactly.
No, I'm actually a brain surgeon.
I know, it never worked. There was a nightclub up in Brisbane called Rosie's.
Yeah.
And all the footballers used to go there, and I'd go there with my buddy, and he was doing cardiothoracic surgery, open heart surgery. And so we went there to pick up girls, and I'd say something like, I'm a brain surgeon and he's an open heart surgeon. Yeah, and the girls would just walk away
Walk straight over to Wendell Saylor and Wally Lewis rather than you.
That's exactly who they went to. It was Mal Meninga and Wal Lewis were in Rosie's when we were there. And you were absolutely right. They had all the girls around them. We had no one around.
They were playing State of Origin and playing for Australia and the Broncos in Canberra.
Yep.
All you were doing was saving lives every day. Okay, so you're 28. You're up there in Brizzy. You play in the field.
Yeah.
At what point does that change? What time? When do you fall in love and when do you start being a family man?
So I had met Genevieve before then, but she'd gone overseas and we both agreed that, she'd gone for a year. And when she came back, I realised that, I didn't realise. Again, mumbled and fumbled my way through that because I didn't realise how good I had it until I lost it. So it was one of those things where, we just went along for years, actually, and I was very happy with my cake and wanting to eat it. And she goes, well, bugger this, if you're not going to marry me, it's not that I don't love you, but I'll go and find someone else who's willing to marry me.
Yeah.
And when I lost her, then I go, oh, shit, maybe I should agree to get married.
Okay, so what's the engagement like? Do you get down on bended knee? Did you get a ring?
No, look, I'm not the romantic type, as my current partner will tell you. and my daughters tell me all the time that I'm a bit of a philistine when it comes to women and relationships. And, I'm divorced now, as you know.
Yes.
And the reason I'm divorced is because I was never a very good husband. Life was always revolved around me. I never really appreciated the sacrifices Genevieve was making. I never voiced my appreciation of her. I never sort of made her feel that she was appreciated. I'm just terrible at that sort of stuff. Not dissimilar to my father and my mother.
Yeah, literally about to say that.
A bad communicator when it comes to that. And, so I mumbled and fumbled my way through that. And it was a great marriage. She was a great wife, a great mother. And I just essentially blew it in the last 10 years. Where I devoted all my time to neurosurgery, very little time to her. And I was just telling Keisha, actually, that it was one of those empty nest type syndromes where, the kids go, you've lost that common bond. At that stage, you should be spending more time with your wife, making sure she knows how much you appreciate her and what she's done for your career. And I didn't do that. I dove into neurosurgery more when the kids left home. Not the relationship, but to work.
The fact that you can talk about that as progress with your new relationship now, are you better at communicating
No.
You know, the hard stuff?
No. Still bad.
So you know you're bad. You're a smart person. At what point do you go, I'm going to do something a little bit differently?
Oh, look, I try. But the fact that I actually have to try doesn't come naturally. It's not good. I mean, you know, it should come naturally, but it doesn't. It just doesn't. I'm very old-fashioned. Very, very old school where guys don't cry. They don't wear their heart on their sleeves. They certainly don't tell their wives how much they love them or appreciate them. It's just, you just don't do that.
How's that working out for you?
No, not good.
Because I'm here to tell you that's, I can understand why you feel that way. And going back to that generational stuff you spoke about before, it's just embedded in you. But I know there's so many blokes. Like I spoke to a group of men on Saturday up on the Gold Coast at a seminar, and I'm all talking about, you know, showing vulnerability and Gotcha for Life. My charity is all about, you know, what does it take to be a man today compared to when the rules were set all those years ago? When I get feedback like, oh, mate, you know, this young generation, they're soft. They've just got to get on with things. I say, okay, well, there's Christmas coming up. Imagine your grandson or your granddaughter walking into Christmas and not feeling like they can talk to you about something that they're worried about. That would make you sad. In fact, you've brought up some type of shield where I don't talk to granddad about that because that's not what granddad does. And I'm saying that's why we need to change, not for any other reason than to just be open to have those discussions that could really clear the mind of someone that you absolutely adore who's growing up in a different world to the world that we grew up in.
Yeah. No. Look, I'm intelligent enough to know that unless I change, things are going to be bad for me with this relationship. I mean, I've got this perfect partner now who loves me dearly. I love her dearly. She's very giving, very understanding emotionally. Her EQ is like 160, whereas my EQ is 60. Mm. So I know I have to change or else I'm going to lose her. But shit, Gus, I just, no matter how intelligent I am, no matter how much awareness I have, I'm struggling. I really struggle.
Yeah. You even telling her that is a huge, huge thing for her to hear. The fact that you acknowledge it and that you are trying your best, but it's bloody hard for you, that is an absolute, just do that as a starting point.
That is a good starting point, but on a daily basis, it's important to recognize those things as well. And then, see, what I do is I fall back into the old-fashioned sort of sexist, male dominant, breadwinner role. I mean, because I love that role. I love the old-fashioned role of me looking after my woman and caring for her, providing for her, but never sort of nurturing her emotional needs. No.
Yeah.
No, I wouldn't do that.
And the emotional needs are the most important.
Well, it turns out they are.
Yeah.
Yeah, my marriage would have been more successful had I realized that.
Yeah.
But
well, the fact you've been given a second chance with someone that you obviously adore, time to change it up. I'm here to tell you, Charlie, as a friend of yours and someone that I admire greatly,
right?
There are many people in this world that I admire greatly that could be better in these type of things. So yeah. I'm on a bit of a crusade, not to say that I have all the answers, but to be vulnerable enough to understand it and to just have a go. And a lot of the time I did a speed dating thing for a show I did on the – I'd been married 20-odd years.
Right.
And still married to the same lady. But we had a night where I speed dated with some really lovely-looking ladies in Sydney with 10 other blokes. And believe me, if there was a rating of between 1 and 10 of good looks, I'm coming in at number 10. At the end of the night, I had a tick from every girl.
Wow.
Now, there was a bloke there that looked like James Bond, beautiful body, the whole bit, and he was a really nice guy. He had 6 out of 10 and right. Everyone else was under that. And when we sat down with smart people afterwards, it was that the women were quite happy with the good-looking guy and the body and everything. That was fine. But most importantly, they wanted to see someone who was authentic and real.
Right.
And the simple fact is that most men don't quite know how to do that.
No.
And it's difficult for us.
Well, because it makes you vulnerable. And, you know, when you're holding on to that rule of being the not vulnerable person, then you don't. No, the last thing you want to do is show vulnerability. And by showing your emotions, you're showing vulnerability.
Yeah.
I'd much rather not cry and not show any sort of emotion than do that because, again, it's what I was raised to be. I was raised to be that sort of person, that bloke.
We're leading with vulnerability. in 2024. Oh, and I'm going to text. I'm going to text you every week, and I'm going to remind you, as I do with many. I'm adding you to the list.
Oh, I guess.
Of brilliant people who just, you know, like if I had something wrong or someone that I loved and you could help, I would ring you. So I feel I can help you with this because I'm certainly in touch of that, with that side of me.
Right, right.
Okay, we've gone off. We've gone off, but that happens. That happens. So you get married.
Yes.
You found your passion. You fumbled and bumbled your way into that. Yeah. So life's pretty good.
Life's very good, actually. Yeah. Well, not I won't say that. I always wanted to stay in Australia. I love Australia. And I found that my personality just didn't fit.
What do you mean by that?
So when I was a registrar, for example, I could never No. Right from when I started medicine, I could never play the game. Like, I hate to say this because it means that anyone who's been successful, so-called successful in medicine, has played the game. But so here's the game, Gus. The game, unfortunately, is that medicine by definition is a hierarchy. I mean, it is. It's a hierarchy. You've got the professor, you've got the registrar, you've got the resident, you've got the medical student. You know, there's this hierarchy. And playing the game means that you can't piss off the person above you because they've got the power over you. Okay, so what does it mean by not pissing them off? It means basically regurgitating what they're telling you. And that's right from the get-go. Before you get into medicine, you've got to get 99.95 in the HSC. How do you do that? Regurgitate. It's all about spitting back facts and so you get good marks. So that's how you get into medicine. When you're in medicine, you're taught by your professor. And God forbid if you started sort of questioning your professor. So what you're meant to do there is, again, regurgitate, okay? And then when you're a doctor, God forbid if you do anything that's against evidence-based medicine or consensus. So again, you're meant to toe the party line, play the game. And someone like me who finds it hard to play the game, actually that's an understatement, who finds it impossible to play the game, it's a struggle right from the get-go because even when I was a resident, I was antagonizing my superiors. And then when I was a registrar, I antagonized my consultants. And then when I became a doctor, I realized that this is not my game here. I need to go somewhere else where I can be honest to myself, be true to myself, say what I believe, do what I believe, and not just toe the party line. And I'm sorry, but a country as small as Australia, where everyone knows everyone and everyone's in everyone's back pocket and got to belong to the club, someone like me just doesn't work. And so I struggled. I was fired as a registrar, kicked off the training scheme. Like I told you, I was doing pediatric surgery, kicked out of the pediatric surgery training scheme because I pissed off the professor.
So there's nothing wrong with your skills. It's your mouth, it's your attitude, it's your... I can't just cop this. So you are rude back to them. You're not playing the game. Is that what you mean by that?
That's exactly what I mean. Even my greatest detractors today, if you speak to anyone, will tell you that I'm a talented surgeon, a very good surgeon. No one has ever questioned my surgical abilities. They've questioned my decision-making, sure, but you know, decision-making is a very, very personal thing. So no one has questioned my talents as a surgeon or as a doctor. What they've questioned is my ability to toe the party line. I mean, you think that this latest controversy is me operating on a patient that everyone has said is inoperable, and they want me to call a tumor inoperable when they call it inoperable. Well, I'm not prepared to do that, I'm sorry. You know, if I truly believe that I can take out a tumor when everyone else has called it inoperable, even though the risk is high and it's putting my career and my reputation on the line, I'll still say it. I'll still say, look, there's a chance I can take that tumor out. There's a chance I can prolong your life. Sure, it's high risk. Sure, everyone else has said it can't be done, but I think I can do it. And then the patient decides. But with that attitude, look what's happened. It just doesn't go down well. They want me to say, you know, if someone else has called inoperable, they want me to call inoperable. If someone else has told them the risk of surgery is 70% chance of death, even if my figures show the risk is 5% of death, they want me to say the risk is 70% of death, just like them. Sorry, not prepared to do that.
So you leave Australia?
Yeah. Yeah, so I left Australia to train in America to do a thing called a fellowship, where you've done your basic training here, and then you go to and put the icing on the cake. And when I went to America to do my fellowship, I realized that America was more sort of my personality. And that is, it's a meritocracy, as you know. And sure, there's a tall poppy syndrome in all countries, but it really isn't very strong in America. In America, if you're good, you tell everyone you're good, and they go, oh, okay. And they worship you for it, and they respect you for it, and they surround you with other good people, and it elevates you, and it elevates them, and everyone's happy. And that's how America works. It's a true meritocracy. And so when I was over there and I thought I was pretty damn good, everyone else thought I was pretty damn good, and I got rewarded for it. You know, assistant professor to associate professor to full professor to being, you know, searched out by all these different institutions, offered jobs at UCSD, UCLA, and I loved it. I just loved it. I really found not only my calling in neurosurgery, but my place, I thought.
Why did you not just stay there?
Well, it's Genevieve and the family. Genevieve had made huge sacrifices for my career. She had a great career herself and gave that up to...
What was her career in?
She was a set designer for movies and TV shows and stuff, and very talented, very good at it, and basically gave it up to support me and the family.
At what stage did you have kids? Did you have kids before you went to America, or did you have them in the States?
No, we had our first child while I was a registrar still.
So the family started, she gives up her work, you go to the States, everything's going well, and at some stage...
She had this insight that I never had, that once children get to a certain age and they're in America, they become Americans, and that's their home. So she said to me very clearly, if you want America to be our home and never go back to Australia, fine, let's stay, and the children will be identified as Americans. But they're at the age now that if you want to go back to Australia, you have to go now. Yeah. So she put the pressure on me to come back.
Yep.
I knew I wouldn't be successful back here. I just knew it. I knew that I'd be struggling the whole time. And I was right.
So if you could have those moments back, would you have said, no, that's okay. We're going to stay here. The kids are going to be American. And that's what's happening. If you could have that moment back.
Ooh, oh, my God. I've never thought about that. No one's ever asked me, nor have I ever thought. Well, it's one of those questions where I think I'm going to upset a lot of people either way, whether I say yes or no. But so I'll just be honest with you and say, if I had the blessing of Genevieve, yeah, I think my career would have been easier in the States.
Yes.
Well, it was. I can tell you now, I was there for years and it was very easy. I just kept getting promoted. And people would come and watch me operate, and I'd be invited everywhere to give talks. And it was very easy.
As soon as you talked about America, your face lit up. You probably didn't even realize it, but you actually it took you to a happy place.
It did. I loved it. Just loved everything about it.
So you come back to Oz, and we know there's been some brilliant bits, and there's been some bits that are controversial and so forth because of your style and your personality and the way that you like to do things.
Mm-hmm.
A close friend of both of ours, Gavin Robinson, who you did incredible work on, will say that he is one of many, many, many people that are around today being who he is because of you. When I talk to him, he just says that you're the greatest at what you do. Why do you think there's so much controversy at times around that particular statement?
Yeah, because I've never denied it. Yeah, because when you say something like that, I mean, in Australia, you're meant to say, no, I'm no better than anyone else, and I'm no different to anyone else. That's what you're meant to say, and I've never said that. I've always said that I'm fantastic at brain tumors, and I'm a great brain tumor surgeon, and I think I'm the best in the world when it comes to brain tumors, and that doesn't go down well.
Mm.
I mean, a sportsman can say it, as you know.
Yeah.
But no one else can say that.
Yeah.
Just doesn't go down well with the Australian vernacular and the Australian sort of mentality.
Yeah.
And, you know, why haven't I learnt my lesson? I'm an idiot, really. Because, you know, if I had gone quiet, rejected all the TV and all the media type stuff, if I had been like everyone else and, you know, oh, I can't take that brain tumour out. No, if you can't, sir, I can't, sir. I'd be well accepted here. And I would never have caused as much controversy, and I wouldn't have been the target of media outlets, and I would, I'd be sitting pretty, I think. But, you know, I'm not, Gus, I just can't do it.
It's not who you are.
It's not who I am. I'd be dishonest with myself.
Yeah. That's you being your authentic self.
Yeah. Look, I'm not a... I won't say... You know, a lot of people have accused me of being a narcissist. But in fact, I think I'm the opposite, because a narcissist is someone who's just so in love with themselves that they don't think they can improve themselves. I'm always actually very self-critical and I'm always trying to prove something. Like, my father used to beat me up and call me a coward. So I sometimes think that maybe I do all these things to prove that I'm not a coward. So I think I'm the actually opposite of a narcissist. I'm always trying to better myself or do better or be better. Because I don't think I'm good enough as I am.
So when you do the type of work that you do, there's obviously the positive side, like the Robbos, and there's, you know, countless names of people that you've saved. And then you've got the other side to it as well. Is that always something that you knew, that when you're doing the type of stuff that you're doing, that you know that it can go either way sometimes?
Oh, my God, absolutely. And we all know that. Any person who has someone else's life in their hands knows that, you know, things can go sour and go the other way. But with my particular subspecialty of really difficult brain tumours, I absolutely know it. It's on the forefront of my thinking and my decision-making and my actions that I know, this is operating the other day. And while you're operating, you're just thinking about it all the time. You know, if I push a bit too far there, or if I try and take that last bit of tumour out, could I actually hurt this person? And it's constantly on your mind.
When you're doing the surgery, before the surgery, and you're having the discussions with the parents or the patient or whatever it might be, and loved ones, there's obviously so much emotion and stuff that is there. Does anything ever get done without their permission, without them signing off, even though they probably don't know a lot of the words that you're saying and they're in the probably emotional state where they just want a Hail Mary?
Well, that is the problem. The problem, and that's what the lawyers use. So we all get someone to sign a consent, but the lawyers say to you, well, signing that consent, they were under duress and they really didn't know what they were signing. And that, unfortunately, is the factor that is so variable, that some people know exactly what they want. They voice it. They know it. The family knows it. Everyone's on the same page and, you know, Bob's your uncle. Everyone's happy. Whether the outcome's good or bad, everyone's happy because, you know, it's right up front. The grey zones are people who are making decisions based on what they think their family wants them to do or what they think the doctor wants to do, not what they really want to do. And then, of course, there's all that miscommunication in the room. Like, they say you only hear about a third of everything the doctor tells you. So some people just want to hear the good stuff, and you can tell them until you're black and blue that there's a risk of death or a risk of paralysis, but they just don't hear that. For a lawyer or someone else to sit in judgment of a doctor for what goes on in that room is just so wrong, because there's so many variables and so much going on in that room. The complexity is such that it's like this, you know, when I come out with a statement, it's not just a statement, it is a reflection of years and years of experience, reading the literature, your own personality, interpreting what that person wants. It's so many complexities that goes into that one statement, I think you should have surgery. Well, it's not just I think you should have surgery. It's I think you should have surgery for the following reasons, because you're this sort of person, I'm this sort of person. The last 100 cases I did this, I read the literature last night, they said that. It's like all these things that go into making that one statement. So for a lawyer to come along and go, you know, you shouldn't have said there was a 5% risk, you should have said there was a 70% risk, you know. Oh, my God, I said a 5% risk, number one, because there was. Number two, because this person knows that this is a risky operation. They know that it's so risky that other people have called it inoperable. I'm not going to sit there and just tell them, you know, there's a 70% chance of death and this and that, and, you know, every time I cut this and cut that and... You know, they've come to you because they want some shred of hope. And they want to hear how you would treat them if they were your loved ones. And that's what I do. It's not what the party wants me to do. It's not what everyone else wants me to do. Everyone else wants me to, you know, present this case in front of an MDT, multidisciplinary team, get consensus, listen to what someone else has said. Don't like doing that. I don't like doing it because... There's very good evidence that you shouldn't do it anyway. There is no evidence in the medical literature that presenting a case to an MDT improves the prognosis or the quality of life of patients. It's about, you know, thousands of articles. There's two articles that says it does, but every other article says no. The thing that really influences prognosis is the experience of the practitioner. The more experience, the more they do at that particular thing, the better they get at it. So to me, presenting in front of a whole group of other people, some of whom I don't respect, some of whom are very meek and mild and won't say anything anyway, even if they have a good opinion, they won't say it, is just a, to me, it doesn't gel. I like treating my patients the way I would treat a member of my own family. That's my benchmark. Treat them like you want the very best for them. And it works. In the majority of times, it works. Mm. Sometimes, of course, as you know from the media, some people are unhappy, and they're unhappy usually because of miscommunication. But at the end of the day, I say to my patients, I can make you one promise and one promise only. Not that you're going to get a good outcome, or I'm going to get the tumor out, or you won't have a stroke. All I say to them is, I will try my hardest and do the best I can. That's the only promise I make.
For someone who's not particularly emotional, is it hard for you to have discussions when things go good or bad? Like, do you feel those emotions when you're talking to patients and their families after outcomes good or bad?
Yeah, I mean, as you get older, you become more emotional. When you have children, you become more emotional. But I don't like crying in front of patients. I don't like showing, again, that sort of vulnerability. And I used to find it not too difficult, but difficult. When I started having children, I found it even more difficult because I started relating children to my own children. And God, what if that was my child that died or got diagnosed with a malignant brain tumor? And I remember the first time I cried in front of a patient was a child, because the child was exactly the same age as my daughter at the time. And now that I'm older, you know, as you get older, you cry in front of movies now. You never used to do before.
The old Telstra ads or the Qantas ads. Oh, those Qantas ads when they're jumping on the plane in London and getting home to surprise mum at the, oh, that gets me every time.
Oh, no, that doesn't get me. I'm not that bad, guys. But, I do. The discussion is very, very difficult because you can't help but carry some of the emotion yourself and relate to them. I don't know, call me old-fashioned, but I don't like it when I cry in front of patients. It's almost showing a weakness, and I'd like to be strong for them. You know what I mean?
Yes. We've skipped right over you being a dad, so you've reminded me, talking about the kids. How much do you love your kids?
Yeah, I mean, again, it's all cliches, but the love of your children is indomitable. It's insurmountable. It's infinity. It's like everything. So I feel really sorry for people who don't have a relationship with the children, because that is it, isn't it? I mean, really, they're your immortality. Mm. So when you're on your deathbed and you have to reflect on your life, to know that your DNA, that your love and nurturing has gone into something that has, something that's very lovely and special, is the way you die in peace, I think.
Mm.
So if you didn't have that, if you had children who you couldn't relate to, or they couldn't relate to you, or you didn't have a relationship with, I think that'd be the worst thing ever.
How many kids and what balance have you got, boys and girls?
Well, I've got no balance. As punishment to me for being a Philistine, I've got four daughters.
Mm.
In fact, I love telling this story, but at one stage in my life, in fact, for several years, all four daughters were getting their periods at different times. So there was incredible emotion in the house, plus my wife went through 5 years of menopause. So a menopausal wife, four girls, all having the periods at different times, it's no wonder I put so much effort into my work. And
that is the ultimate payback, my friend. That is the ultimate payback right there.
I don't know if that's a sexist thing to say, but I mean, I think most women agree that, you know, emotions run riot during those years, those formative years when estrogen's very, very high or very, very low.
Mm. Are you a good dad?
I'd like to think I am, yeah. And
if I asked the girls, would they say you're a good dad?
They would say I had my weaknesses, but they know that I put so much time and effort into them. I used to take them away everywhere I went. They'd do rounds with me. They'd go overseas with me. If I was operating in Peru, we'd do Machu Picchu. If we were operating in Cambodia, we'd do Angkor Wat. You know, Vietnam, they'd come and go through the tunnels with me. We did everything. Operating in Egypt, they did the Nile with me. So, I took them everywhere, put a lot of time and effort into them, loved them dearly. And, I think they'd say I was a good dad, but they'd also tell you that I was an absolute Philistine when it came to emotion and displaying emotion and appreciating, you know, my partners.
Granddad yet?
Granddad now.
Are you a better granddad than you were a dad?
No, I'm scared I'm not going to be a good granddad.
Why?
Because I'm a control freak. And so with your children, you've got total control over them and you can formulate their personalities and their behavior. I used to love doing that. I love telling this story and hopefully some fathers will learn from it. So when I was in Little Rock, Arkansas, there was a cafe called the Purple Cow. And the Purple Cow, you'd sit in your little booth, but it wasn't separated from the other booth but apart from a partition. So in other words, you could hear everything that was going on in the next booth. And this couple came in with their child and they spent the first 5-10 minutes arguing about whose turn it was to look after the kid because he was such a little brat. No, I looked after him last week or yesterday, it's your turn. And then I thought to myself, oh, shit, if they had made him the sort of kid that they would enjoy being around, then the argument wouldn't be about whose turn it was to look after him. It was, you know, sorry, it's my turn to look after him. You had your turn last week.
Yeah, yeah.
So I pledged at that time that I would never have that relationship with my children. I would make them the sort of people who I would enjoy being around. And that means that they weren't allowed to cry, for example. And now I'll never forget, like 2 o'clock in the morning, we were catching a plane, we'd missed the plane, we're lining up, the kids were tired, and one of the kids started crying, and I go, stop that, you know? And the person behind me goes, oh, it's 2 o'clock in the morning, they're tired, you should let her cry. And no, I'm not going to let her cry because I don't like that sort of behavior. So they behaved in the way that I just loved their company. And I made sure they knew that. And for example, I let them swear because it didn't bother me. But Genevieve hated them swearing. So they knew they couldn't swear around Genevieve, but they knew they could swear around me. Mm. And so it's all about making your children the sort of people that you would want to be around, that you enjoy being around. So I just loved their childhood because I just loved their company and I still do. They're the sort of people now who, if they weren't my family, they'd be my best friends. You know, they're really good company.
That's really lovely.
They're positive. They've got humor. They see the world in the big picture. They know that they're global citizens. They also have a sense of charity and giving. I love them. And I take credit for that. I take credit for that because I put a lot of effort into making them those sort of people.
Yeah, lovely. That's lovely. What about you now? What's happening now for you? We're sitting in a very nice, medical-looking office, which your daughter designed and so forth. It's beautiful. It's spectacular. What's Charlie Teo now and the next 10 or 15 for you before you maybe put your feet up?
Yeah, so this is what I'm really proud of. Because everyone comes up and says, oh, I'm so sorry, you must be going through terrible times and, you know, it's hard and stuff. But I'm not. I'm not in a bad space. I'm in a very good space. I have good mental fortitude. I never get depressed. And when things like this happen, it's almost like I think to myself, well, one door closes, another opens. That which doesn't kill you makes you stronger. And I'm really pleased at what they've done to me. Because if they hadn't done to me what they've done to me, I would never have got into what I'm getting into now. And I'm really proud of what I'm getting into now.
Can you tell us in a nutshell what exactly they've done to you?
Well, I can't operate in Australia. So, again, no one said I'm a bad surgeon, so they can't take my license. They haven't taken my license off me. I've done nothing wrong. But what I've done is I've alienated the media and I've alienated my colleagues. And that's enough to make it impossible to operate in Australia. So even though I have a full license to practice as an independent surgeon, no one will give me privileges. No hospital is giving me privileges.
Which means you can't use their
facility.
Yeah. So if something happened to me now, or Keisha, our beautiful producer, who basically runs this podcast, by the way, I should just thank you for that, Keisha, one more time. something happened to us right now and you had to perform surgery on us somewhere, you'd bring us into the local hospital where they wouldn't let you do the surgery.
Exactly. I don't have privileges in any hospital.
So when you first heard that, that must have knocked you for six in some way.
Oh, yeah, because the hospital that I was working at, Prince of Wales Private Hospital, I had devoted my time to them and I'd loved the hospital and I promoted it. You know, I brought in a lot of money for them, I'm sure, with all the patients that I operated on. And they dumped me. They dumped me because I was too high, in their words, I was too high risk. With the media against me and my colleagues against me, I was just too high risk.
That must have saddened you to feel like you haven't got their backing when you'd given them so much.
Oh my God, so much. But again, I've got to suck it up. I've got to take some of the blame there. You know, you might not want to include this. I'm happy if you want to include it, but it's a long story. But the story was that during COVID, I was asked to operate on a kid down in Melbourne. And Melbourne was shut. So I had to get permission to go down to Melbourne and then come back and operate because I had a sick kid coming from Perth and I couldn't afford to go into quarantine and not operate. So Brad Hazzard gave me special permission to go down to Melbourne, operate on the kid, not leave the hospital, not leave the hotel, come straight back to Sydney and work. And the hospital administrators knew that. So they knew that this arrangement had been made. So I go down, operate, get the tumour out. Everyone's happy. The kid had had two previous operations, couldn't get the tumour out. He was dying. He was too sick to come to Sydney. That's why I had to go down to Melbourne. And so I was pumped and everything was great. Came back to Sydney, go to the hospital to operate on this little kid from Perth. And they stopped me from going to the hospital. I go, what the fuck? And he goes, no, sorry, you've got to quarantine for 2 weeks. I go, hang on, you gave me special permission to go down there. I did everything right, got permission off the Minister for Health. And he tried to make excuses about how the nurses didn't want to work with me because I could be COVID, this and that. And it was all bullshit. It turned out that the doctors at the hospital got wind of the fact that I was getting this special permission and they got jealous and they said, no, if you let him operate, we won't operate. So he acquiesced to the other surgeons. And rather than accept that, I just hit the roof and I go, well, you've lost all my respect. You know, what you should have done is told those guys to get back in their box. You should have respected what I had done. And now this little girl from Perth is going to die. And she did. She ended up dying. And so from that point on, I said to that CEO, I said, you've lost my respect. Fuck you. And so we had a terrible relationship. He'd say, oh, Charlie, can you come up and speak to me about something? And I'd go, fuck off.
Right. Yeah.
I'm telling you, I'm my worst enemy. Absolutely my worst enemy. All I would have had to do is swallow it and play the game and go, yes, you're right, and this and that. And
you don't do that.
But I don't do that. So no one else can be blamed except me. You know, I should have played the game. I should have done exactly... You know, oh, don't worry about the little girl. You know, I understand why you're in this position. Then I would have still be operating. I'd still be operating in Australia if I'd done that. But I ruined the relationship between me and that hospital because
they also went back on something that they said they were going to do too. So
they did.
Two sides.
They did, but that's politics, Gus. That happens all the time. You know, duplicity and politics are synonymous, I reckon. And, you know, the day I realise that is the day my life will become easier where I just play the game.
Yeah.
Play the game.
Not sure if you'll ever get there, Charlie, to be honest. It's just not your thing.
No. Anyway, okay, so the good thing about it is that when I couldn't operate, I had to do something. I love helping people. And so I got into this new software that you know about.
Mm.
And the new software now can map your brain and not only tell you what your brain looks like, but how your brain is functioning. So that has opened up this huge, amazing technology that can now scan someone and tell them how their brain is working. So it can now see depression, happiness, anxiety, PTSD, Alzheimer's, autism, all those conditions that you would scan someone and just see a normal brain. We can now scan them and show abnormalities. And the beauty about that is that with those abnormalities, those personalized maps of someone's brain, we can actually modify those networks and help all those conditions that cause functional problems with the brain. So for the last 3 years, we've been treating patients with depression and anxiety using this targeted, personalized approach. And our results, which we've published now, are better than any other published series. So if you look at TMS, transcranial magnetic stimulation, non-targeted, non-personalized, the results are somewhere between 29 and 40% success rate. We've published our paper showing a 90% success rate with targeted, focused, personalized TMS. So it's really groundbreaking. It's world first. We've got patients coming from all around the world to be treated with depression, and our results are just fantastic.
So how do we how does this become something that everyone can learn about and can afford? I'm assuming it's reasonably expensive.
Yes, it's it's bad because it's Charlie Teo, and so a lot of people are anti Charlie Teo and hence anti whatever Charlie Teo is doing. There'll be people out there, as you know, who will want to destroy this whole thing because it's me. And the fraternity, the psychiatry fraternity is, I hate to say it, but probably more conservative than the neurosurgical fraternity. And something like TMS, which has been around for 3 decades, transcranial magnetic stimulation has been around for 3 decades with a track record. Sure, you know, 29 to 40% results, but still, that helps some people. And yet many authorities and many leading figures in psychiatry in Australia are not accepting it. And the literature's clear. It's not as if it's in dispute. They are coming around, and now there are some CPT codes for TMS for depression, but it's been very, very slow. It's hard to pick up, and a lot of psychiatrists are just not into TMS and targeted treatment. They're more into pharmacology, and again, there's reasons for that, which we won't go into.
Yeah.
But at the moment, you can't get TMS for depression unless you've failed 2 drugs. And even then, when you get TMS, the government won't pay for anything but 2 treatments. And most treatments are about 25 to 30 treatments. So it's expensive. It's not well accepted, even though the literature is very clear. And I think it's going to be a bit of an upward battle for a while. In 10 years' time, we're going to look back and go, oh, my God. But
why do we take so long?
Why do we take so long?
Okay. Charlie, we could talk forever. I want to ask you the final fast 5 questions. Favorite movie?
Oh, that's easy. The Bourne series.
Oh, how good. Yeah. Brilliant. Have you got a favorite quote?
That which doesn't kill you makes you stronger.
Like that. Favorite holiday destination?
Being with my partner in Winuna.
Okay. That's good. Good answer. See? You've tapped into a bit of vulnerability there. I noticed it. It took you a while to get there, but you got there. Favourite book? Are you a reader of non-medical stuff?
No. My favourite book is, it's a medical book.
Okay.
Yeah. Sorry.
Not too sexy then.
No.
Just chiming in here, normally at this stage we ask the guest where the $10,000 should go. Well, Charlie, he decided to split it up within a few different charities. One in particular that he only just became aware of, and he said they're desperate for funds, so I want to make sure they'll look after them. Some of the funds are going to the Charlie Teo Foundation, which puts money towards brain cancer research. Voiceless, which gives a voice to industry animals. Zambi Wildlife, that give a forever home to discarded wildlife in Australia. And lastly, Vila Kitty, Indonesia's rescue shelter for cats and dogs. Big shout out again to Shaw and Partners Financial Services for that $10,000.
Charlie, thank you so much. It's been lovely to talk to you. Good to catch up with you again. And I'm reminding you, I'm going to be texting you to get a little bit more vulnerable, okay, for your relationship with your kids and your new girlfriend's sake.
Well, it's very kind, Gus, but don't be surprised if I block you.
No, if you block and ignore me, I know where you live. Thanks, Charlie.
Okay, thank you.
I hope you enjoyed the chat that I had with Charlie Teo. Hopefully you saw a side of him that perhaps you didn't think was there. You can see this podcast on our YouTube channel. All the details are in our show notes. And I'll catch you next week for another fantastic episode of Not An Overnight Success, even if I say so myself.